Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lorine. Coming up, we're going to talk with two local historians about the year that we just went through, and we'll talk a lot about the Trump administration. Later on this program, we'll listen back to portions of that controversial phone call that the president made to the Georgia Secretary of State, pressuring him to overturn the results of the Georgia election. And then we'll open up the phone lines later on in the program. By the way, Frank Knox is our phone producer today. First up today, a comment about last Friday's program. Last Friday, we were talking briefly about people that believe in conspiracy theories, especially the theory that there are lizard aliens controlling the world. And here's what one listener had to say after that.
Hello, this is Jeff from Tampa. Yeah, I'm just calling about a caller who called on the previous program. He was talking about in conspiracy theories and how it started with David Icke. I know he's one of the big conspiracy theorists. And I thought he said that David Icke had died, but I believe he's still alive. I mean, at least according to Wikipedia, it lists him as, it doesn't list him as dead. And even there's a website. And even if you go on there, you'll see giving like some kind of a message, welcome to 2021. And I know I've heard that he's been banned from a lot of platforms, but apparently he's still around. And so I guess some of his conspiracy theories will continue to live on.
That was a listener comment about last Friday's show. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Well, right now we're going to hear Florida This Week, which is a program that originally airs on the PBS station WEDU-TV. And this week we're going to take a look back at the big news of 2020, including the pandemic and the president's loss in the November election, with two noted local historians. So we'll do that next. And as we listen back to the program, please feel free to write in your comments about the topics we're discussing. You can send your email to dj@wmnf.org. Here is Florida This Week. Coming up, we'll talk with two of the most knowledgeable historians in the U.S., and they live right here in the Tampa Bay area. Both Ray Arsenault and Gary Mormino have been prolific authors, lecturers, and professors at the University of South Florida in St. Petersburg. They've been writing about the history of Florida and the U.S. for decades. We'll ask them how history will remember the year 2020 on a special edition of Florida This Week. Welcome back. For decades, two inquisitive minds taught Florida history out of the same office at USF in St. Petersburg. Ray Arsenault is the John Hope Franklin Professor of Southern History at the school and is the longest-serving faculty member. He's written extensively about the civil rights movement with books about the Freedom Riders, Arthur Ashe, and singer Marian Anderson. Gary Mormino is the Frankie Duckwall Professor Emeritus of Florida History at USF St. Pete and a scholar in residence at the Florida Humanities Council. His books about Florida include Land of Sunshine, State of Dreams, The Immigrant World of Ybor City, and Italians in Florida. Together, they created the Florida Studies program at USF St. Petersburg in 2003, and we're very happy to have both on as guests on the special New Year's edition of Florida This Week. Gary and Ray, great to see you.
Great to be here.
Glad to be here.
And I should say, Gary, that photo of your office was not Photoshopped. That's an actual photo of your office, which I love. So let me talk about some of the things that have happened this year. These are really unprecedented times. President Trump has been talking about martial law. He wants to overturn the election. This comes as the U.S. leads the world in COVID-19 deaths. Every day we're seeing more deaths than on 9/11. And unemployment was a big problem this year. It reached 14.7% this April, the largest since the Great Depression. Millions of Americans have been affected. Many unemployed people still have not received benefits, state or federal. So with those three things being some of the biggest things that have happened this year, Ray, how do you think historians are going to look back on 2020?
You know, historians are usually loath to make superlative statements. We're trained to talk about shades of gray and nuance, but I have to say I think 2020 will be viewed as probably the worst year in American history. I mean, there have been tough times before. 1861 was secession, and depressions of 1873 and 1893, and 1919, of course, during the last pandemic, and all the kind of anti-immigrant and other kind of movements and rises of the Ku Klux Klan and things like that. 1942, at the lowest point of World War II, but I don't think we've ever seen anything like this. Gary and I have talked a lot about this between tennis games, trying to figure out if we can think about any parallels. But certainly the most distressing year of my life, 1968 was quite a year for the assassinations and the political disruption and the war, Vietnam War. But I just can't remember anything. I've never seen a president talk about declaring martial law before, except during the Civil War. Their habeas corpus was suspended and that kind of thing, but nothing like this. We've never had such a frontal attack on our institutions. And I mean, the COVID thing has put it over the top, I think. And so I think Donald Trump will be seen by historians as the worst president in American history, displacing James Buchanan and Andrew Johnson.
Gary, what's your take overall on how historians will look back at this year?
I think what's most remarkable is it's not simply the COVID crisis, which would be extraordinary in itself, but it's more like a whirlpool or a maelstrom where everything seems to be sucking into one great crisis. But in addition to the worst health crisis in 102 years, we're also facing, as you mentioned, an economic recession that devastated a boom just 9 months ago. The Black Lives Matter movement is a great racial reckoning going on. The Me Too movement was also going on. What we've kind of forgotten in all of this is I think the greatest existential crisis is the climate, what's happening to the climate. So all of these things are going on. It's going to be a challenge for a future historian to wrap all this together.
Ray, there's increased radicalization. And let me start with the right-wing radicalization. Some Americans are talking about a civil war. Rush Limbaugh, the radio talk show host, says that red states and blue states cannot coexist. Some communities are talking about secession. Then at the same time, we've had most of the members, the Republican members of Florida's delegation, 13 out of 16, signed on to the Texas Attorney General, going to the U.S. Supreme Court, trying to overturn the presidential election. Our Attorney General signed on to that. These are pretty radical steps from the conservative side. What do you make of that?
Well, we've heard this kind of rhetoric before in American history. The right wing is an old institution, if you can call it that. But it was generally from what we used to call the lunatic fringe, fringe groups that really didn't have access to mainstream media or obviously not to social media. And they didn't get sanctioned by the President of the United States, by members of Congress, maybe a few. I mean, I spent the first 20 years of my career studying Southern demagogues. And they were a pretty wild and woolly bunch and were capable of all kinds of extreme rhetoric. But I don't think they were anything really to compare with Donald Trump and some of the people in his inner circle. We've never seen it in national politics before. Not the possibility of actually taking over the country, martial law, calling on the military to act as a police force. These are all things that we associated with banana republics or authoritarian, totalitarian regimes. I must say, I feel I was really naive, even though I spent all this time studying race and political protest and all these things. I couldn't have imagined this, frankly, if you'd asked me a year ago or 4 years ago for sure, that we'd be in this situation. I mean, I'm hopeful in the long run. I really am. I think thank God that Joe Biden is the incoming president. I think we have a chance to save American democracy. But I never thought it would be in such peril. I really didn't.
Gary, in the post-World War II era here in Florida, did we have people responding to the civil rights movement in a similar fashion? Did we have elected politicians here in Florida who were upset at what was going on nationally with the movement towards civil rights?
I think probably the best historical precedent would be 1876, not 1968, that in 1876, three southern states had very disputed elections, and they had the Congress, the Supreme Court, had a special panel together, and the Democrats, the Republicans had to win South Carolina, Louisiana, and Florida to win the election, and in fact, the Republicans won all three, and Rutherford B. Hayes, and but that ended Reconstruction. There had been martial law in Florida during Reconstruction.
Mm-hmm. Ray, let's talk about the Black Lives Matter movement, which emerged this year as, I think, the biggest civil rights movement since the 1960s. How would you compare the two? Because you are an expert on the civil rights movement in the 1960s. How would you compare what happened this year with the Black Lives Matter movement and back then in the 60s?
Well, I think it's really in its early stages, even now, and I hope so anyway. I hope it's going to continue. I was very fortunate to be at the 50th anniversary of the Selma to Montgomery March. And I was there with Bernard Lafayette, of course, perhaps Tampa's most famous civil rights activist, who was the voting rights coordinator in Selma in 1962 and 1963. And he had already arranged for a meeting with several dozen Black Lives Matter leaders from Ferguson, mostly. And he asked me to come in into this sort of discussion. They wanted to know what lessons they could learn from the Freedom Rides, the civil rights movement generally. And I hope we gave them some nuggets of wisdom. But I have to say, I came away being so impressed with those young people. I think both Bernard and I felt that we learned as much from them as they learned from us. I mean, the one thing that we tried to impress upon them, which I think they've taken to heart, is there's a difference between a protest movement, a protest and a movement. That you really, if you're in it for the long haul, you need a lot of discipline, a lot of training, particularly if it's going to be a nonviolent movement. You know, you have to plan, and it's not something, it's not spontaneous. It's not going to be over in a week or a month or a year. And I think the way the Black Lives Matter marches were sustained, even though I think they got sort of tarnished by the kind of ancillary, you know, violence, which was, I think, the right wing tried to blame on them and on all the anti-Antifa talk and all of that. But I think generally speaking, the Black Lives Matter people were, they did keep their nonviolent discipline, and they did keep their heads, and I think they drew a lot of people out. I mean, I know people involved in the Black Lives Matter movement who were not involved in any political protest before. So it's really drawn a lot of people in, politicized them, I think in the right way, not in a partisan sense, but just in a deep commitment to justice and freedom and democracy.
You mentioned Bernard Lafayette is still alive. John Lewis, your friend, the former congressman and one of the leaders of the Freedom Rides, died this year. In terms of the lions of the civil rights movement passing, I mean, most of them have moved on, have passed away. What does that do to, you know, what does that do to movements that are looking for equality and justice?
Well, I think one thing that has happened since Dr. King's assassination in 1968 is that the movement fragmented to a great degree. There never again was there one leader. You know, we talk about Dr. King's charisma, and he had that, but the civil rights movement has always been different than a leader-led movement. It's all, people have to reach inside themselves. It's a lot of historical agency and taking responsibility for yourself. So I think the death of any one person is not going to cripple it. It's certainly a loss with not only John Lewis, but C.T. Vivian, Reverend Joseph Lowry. Every time the phone rings, I think it's another Freedom Rider. Someone's going to tell me that they've died. In fact, the last week I got a call from the son of a 91-year-old freedom rider, Cy Dressner. And actually, he wanted to make a documentary film on his father, and he wanted to interview me. He's live and kicking in 91. He actually got COVID and survived it. No symptoms at all. But so they're a tough bunch. I mean, they signed on for life. You know, they're still troublemakers, but you know, as John Lewis said, good trouble. Troublemakers in the best sense of the word. You know, the essence of their movement was they didn't want freedom later, they wanted freedom now, and they're willing to push the edge of the envelope.
Gary, you've written a lot about past epidemics here in Florida, and you've written about yellow fever. And please compare for us how politicians are treating COVID today and how they treated the yellow fever epidemics that swept through Florida in the late 1800s and early 1900s.
Well, ironically, yellow fever and malaria arrived with the African slave trade. And yellow fever scoured southern seaport cities from the 1700s really to almost 1900, probably claiming more lives in epidemics than any single disease. Much more dead. Yellow fever was much more deadly than the coronavirus. I think almost 50% of the victims afflicted died at that time. Tampa was hit a half a dozen times, but particularly in 1878 and 1888. Jacksonville, the worst epidemic proportionally in Florida was in Jacksonville in the late 1880s. Politicians, in many ways, very similar. Immigrants, poor people, African Americans suffered disproportionately. In the late 19th century, there was not even a hospital to care for African Americans. And the Clara Fry, a nurse, opened up her home, which eventually became a hospital in the West Tampa area. Medical quacks, medical panaceas, all were attempted. The problem is they did not know the cause of the epidemic, which was a mosquito. And we responded. We created the Florida Medical Association. People realized you had to clean ditches, etc. So we eventually, that's a happy ending. By 1900, yellow fever was effectively. What connects, I think, yellow fever and the coronavirus and the Spanish flu is this idea that we feel pretty smug. We're an advanced nation. We lick cholera and typhoid and all those things. And the coronavirus has revealed how weak we are. I mean, how vulnerable we are. We're not nearly as smart as we think we are.
And you point out in your writing that there were restrictions on movements. The politicians said, for instance, Tampa was a hotbed of yellow fever. The Jacksonville community said you can't travel from Tampa up to Jacksonville, so there was a ban on that. People carried cards that proved that they had already survived yellow fever. And there was a lot of restrictions on people back then to try to stop the disease.
My favorite story is the town of Bartow in Polk County banned any Tampa refugees. And the Tampa Journal responded, "Who wants to go to Bartow anyway?" But you're right. I mean, there's a lot of similarities.
You know, some of those refugees from Tampa actually were founded St. Petersburg. I mean, you explained that the timing, you know, General Williams, who had a house in Hyde Park and came to and bought this huge tract over here and really started the city.
So do you think that we're at a turning point in American history? Do you think that we're at a standoff? Or do you think that are we in a precursor to something worse? And Ray, let me start with you on that one. What's next?
Well, as I said earlier, I'm really optimistic. And it has a lot to do with demography, you know, population dynamics. Historians like to say demography is destiny. When we can't say anything else, that sort of, you know, sums it up. Sort of, maybe it's overly simplified, but I really think what's happening in terms of the nation moving towards a truly multicultural situation, just look at Joseph Biden's cabinet. What he's trying to do there, and I think doing successfully so far, incorporating groups that were considered to be on the outside, but in fact have had played an enormous role in American history. Immigrants and Native Americans and African Americans, obviously, and Asian Americans, all of that. And they're only going to get stronger. I think that explains why the Republican Party has, in a sense, become hysterical, or at least Trump's version of it. That they're panicking because they can see what's happening, that they can get a preponderance of the white votes and still not control the political structure. And that they're going to have to share power and have to learn how to talk to these other groups and to listen to them. I don't think they've learned that lesson yet at all. And I think it's really to their peril. But I think it's going to be better for the country. I think in 10 years, I mean, obviously the climate crisis is horrific. We're going to have amazing problems to try to deal with. Maybe more pandemics even. I hope not. But I think in terms of our political life, I think there's a real will now to create a true democracy in the United States. I think that's, in an ironic way, that's what the Trump era has provoked, is a response greater, even though we hear all the noise coming from the Trump supporters, but actually the reaction to it, I think, is much greater. The reverse happened in the 1960s. A lot of us were involved in the anti-war movement, civil rights movement. But actually, the reaction to the 60s, the sex, drugs, and rock and roll, had a more lasting political influence. I think this time it's going to be reversed. And it's going to be that liberalization and a real spirit of democracy, which is going to spread, as particularly with the younger people. I think we saw that. That was one of the most encouraging things that happened in the election, that they can't even imagine being homophobic or racist in the traditional sense. And I think just that things are going to get a lot better over time if we can just survive this immediate crisis.
Gary, what do you think? Are we in a standoff or a shift or the time before a major explosion?
Historians are not supposed to write the first draft of history. Journalists, you write the first draft. But so it's always dangerous. As the father of two daughters, as you two are as well, we have to be optimistic about the future. I mean, I'd feel terrible on my deathbed if I thought I'm leaving a worse place than I found it. So I'm optimistic. Ray's right, by the way, about the 1960s. There's that old line, who won the 60s? The Republican Party. They ruled for 28 of the next 40 years in America. Clearly, voters were bothered by defunding the police and libraries being burned and police stations. But I'm still optimistic, particularly about the climate. I think many Floridians during these dark days have found solace in the environment, in walks, in going to the springs, things like that. So I'd like to think we come out of this and we're more sensitive to what we've been doing to the land, and particularly what we have to hand off to the future generation.
But Gary, I'm wondering.
So I guess I'm an optimist here.
Well, you're both optimists, but I'm wondering if every historic era, and Gary, you mentioned the Reconstruction, is a reaction to the previous era. So if the ending of Reconstruction in the late 1800s was a reaction to the Civil War, Do we as Americans just end up bouncing from left to right in kind of a ping-pong fashion, and that's the way our history has gone since the founding of the Republic?
Well, Think about the Spanish flu, the great influenza. We had a terrible recession, but the 20s was a remarkably creative decade. It was also remarkably backlash decade with the Klan and racial violence, but we also had the Jazz Age. The next 2 days were the golden age of literature in Florida. So creativity can come out of harsh times.
Ray, what do you think?
Well, I think the difference now is that the political polarization creates a problem. In other words, we've always had this two-party system. We go back and forth in terms of policy. But when Gary and I were young, and I think we may have preferred Adlai Stevenson or Dwight Eisenhower, but it wasn't really going to change our lives very much which one won the presidential election or which party really was even in control. It used to be, Mark Twain called it Tweedledum and Tweedledee at its worst. That's the choice, a kind of political consensus. We used to complain about that. We didn't really take ideas seriously, that we didn't have enough conflict in American politics to represent the conflict in American society. Well, I think we've got it in spades now. So I think we've got to learn how to manage this bifurcation, this dichotomy, two cultures. I mean, I've lectured for years on the culture wars, and I was wondering if I was right about it. I think I even underestimated it, actually, now. And I think it's very disturbing and frightening. And somehow, it's going to take time to bring the nation together. And it may never come together entirely, but at least where we can live in peace and a certain level of respect. And that's why the recent talk by Trump about treating his opponents as enemies and as enemies of America, and questioning their integrity and their patriotism. That's happened before, but never at this level, not so openly by a president of the United States. Always debated about who was hardest on communism and that sort of thing. But this is way beyond that. And I think we've got to somehow get this out of our system if we're ever going to get back to a nation that's really, worth living in, frankly.
Well, let me just switch from the serious to the amusing, and that we have a minute left. And Gary, let me ask you, we're all younger than this guy, but 77-year-old Mick Jagger just bought a house in the Sarasota area. And both of you have written about immigration to Florida. But Gary, what do you think? Mick Jagger finally moving to Florida, or at least is moving his girlfriend to Florida. What do you make of that after all your writing about immigration?
I can't get no satisfaction. The greatest rock song in American history, written in Clearwater, by the way, in 1974, I believe. No, 1964.
Yeah. Really, Keith Richards moves to Florida.
we'll see. Let's hope. Well, Ray Arsenault and Gary Mormino, thank you for coming on Florida this week.
It's been a lot of fun. Thanks for inviting us.
Thanks.
Well, two of the best local history professors, Gary Mormino and Ray Arsenault from USF St. Petersburg, both worked in the Florida Studies Department there, and that was Florida This Week. If you want to comment about what Gary and Ray said, you can email us here in the studio. The address is dj@wmnf.org. And Mark and Brandon has emailed in. He said, thanks for starting the new year with another great Florida This Week show and guests. Fascinating couple of guys that I would enjoy having an adult beverage with, writes Mark and Brandon. And then David writes, thanks so much for bringing Mormino and Arsenault on your show today. I think that Trump has got to go down in history as the worst president of the U.S. No other president has dropped all pretense of public service and only serves himself like Trump does. I hope that Trump gets exiled to Slovenia. That's David's email. And then Paul forwards something from Huffington Post. He says, Ted Cruz is a member of this group that wants to do away with voters electing U.S. senators. And I think that might be a stepping stone to setting up a dictatorship here down the road. Thought I'd share it with you in case you or a team member are interested. That's Paulie in Ozona. Yeah, there's been the move to elect U.S. senators, that was not originally part of our government, but there was later on a direct election of U.S. senators by citizens put into place in this country, and I'm not familiar with the details of that history, but I'll take a look at it. And there are some people on the far right in this country who think that U.S. senators should be appointed. Well, we'll see where that goes. I want to switch gears a little bit here, and we are going to continue to talk about Donald Trump, but we're going to hear some of those controversial remarks that he made to the Florida Secretary of State over the weekend, in which he appeared to try to bully the Secretary of State into overturning the election results. And the Washington Post reported on Saturday about an hour-long telephone call that Trump made on Saturday to Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger. The Post obtained a recording of the phone call in which Trump appeared to urge Raffensperger, who's a Republican, to manipulate the election by recalculating the results and finding enough votes so that Trump would be declared the winner. During the phone call, Trump oscillated between trying to level with and flatter Raffensperger and then trying to threaten him. During their conversation, Trump issued a vague threat to both Raffensperger and Ryan Germany, the Secretary of State's legal counsel, suggesting that if they don't find that thousands of ballots in Fulton County have been illegally destroyed to block investigators, in an allegation for which there's no evidence, they would be subject to some sort of criminal liability. So that phone call is making the news. We're going to hear part of the phone call right now, and I want to get your thoughts about this. You can send your email into dj@wmnf.org. Here's President Trump over the weekend, along with his chief of staff, speaking with Brad Raffensperger, who is the Secretary of State of Georgia, and Raffensperger's attorney, Ryan Germany.
We have won this election in Georgia based on all of this. And there's nothing wrong with saying that, Brad. You know, I mean, the people of Georgia are angry. And these numbers are going to be repeated on Monday night, along with others that we're going to have by that time, which are much more substantial even. And the people of Georgia are angry. The people of the country are angry. And there's nothing wrong with saying that, you know, that you've recalculated.
Well, Mr. President, the challenge that you have is the data you have is wrong.
Now, do you think it's possible that they shredded ballots in Fulton County? Because that's what the rumor is. And also that Dominion took out machines. That Dominion is really moving fast to get rid of their machinery. Do you know anything about that? Because that's illegal.
No, Ryan Germany. No, Dominion is not. Moved any machinery out of Fulton County. We're having.
But have they moved? Have they moved the inner parts of the machines and replaced them with other parts?
No.
You sure, Ryan?
I'm sure.
You should want to have an accurate election, and you're a Republican.
We believe that we do have an accurate election.
No, I know you don't. No, you don't. You don't have. Not even close. You're off by hundreds of thousands of votes. You know what they did, and you're not reporting it. That's a criminal offense, and you know you can't let that happen. That's a big risk to you and to Ryan, your lawyer. That's a big risk. But they are shredding ballots, in my opinion, based on what I've heard. And they are removing machinery, and they're moving it as fast as they can, both of which are criminal fines, and you can't let it happen, and you are letting it happen. You know, I mean, I'm notifying you that you're letting it happen. So, look, all I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, because we won the state. So tell me, Brad, what are we going to do? We won the election, and it's not fair to take it away from us like this. And it's going to be very costly in many ways. And I think you have to say that you're going to reexamine it, and you can reexamine it, but reexamine it with people that want to find answers, not people that don't want to find answers. For instance, I'm hearing Ryan, and he's probably, I'm sure, a great lawyer and everything, but he's making statements about those ballots that he doesn't know. But he's making them with such, he did make them with surety, but now I think he's less sure, because the answer is they all went to Biden. And that alone wins us the election by a lot. You know, so.
Mr. President, you have people that submit information, and we have our people that submit information.
and then it comes before the court, and the court then has to make a determination. We have to stand by our numbers. We believe our numbers are right.
Well, under law, you're not allowed to give faulty election results, okay? You're not allowed to do that, and that's what you've done. This is a faulty election result. And honestly, this should go very fast. You should meet tomorrow because you have a big election coming up. And because of what you've done to the president, you know, the people of Georgia know that this was a scam. And because of what you've done to the president, a lot of people aren't going out to vote. And a lot of Republicans are going to vote negative because they hate what you did to the president. Okay? They hate it. And they're going to vote. And if you would be respected, if really respected, if this thing could be straightened out before the election. You have a big election coming up on Tuesday.
President Trump pressuring two officials in Georgia, the Secretary of State and the Secretary of State's legal counsel, to change the results of the Georgia election. That recording was an hour long. We heard excerpts from it. I got that from the Washington Post, the sound that we heard there. The Washington Post broke the story. What do you think about what the president is saying there and trying to do? Pressuring Georgia officials to change the results of the election. What do you think? Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. Watergate investigative reporter Carl Bernstein, who used to work for the Washington Post, was on CNN yesterday. He was asked what this phone call means, and here's what he had to say.
It's not deja vu. This is something far worse than occurred in Watergate. We have both a criminal president of the United States in Donald Trump and a subversive president of the United States at the same time in this one person, subverting the very basis of our democracy and willing to act criminally in that subversion. But more important, what we hear on this tape, this is the ultimate smoking gun tape. It is the tape with the evidence of what this president is willing to do to undermine the electoral system and illegally, improperly, and immorally try to instigate a coup in which he remains the president of the United States. And in any other presidency, this tape would be evidence enough to result in the impeachment of the president of the United States, his conviction in the Senate of the United States, and really an immediate call by the members of Congress, including of his own party, that he resign immediately. That's really what we ought to be hearing from Republicans at this moment. Mr. President, resign. Leave the White House. This is unconscionable. It is wrong. And we of your party will not permit it. Now, we're not going to hear that. We might from a few Republicans, but that's what's really called for here. And the one thing we should recall from Watergate is that the heroes of Watergate were Republicans who would not tolerate Richard Nixon's conduct.
That was Carl Bernstein, the investigative reporter on CNN yesterday, after he was asked to comment about the Trump phone call to the Georgia Secretary of State. What do you think? Bernstein there calls this worse than Watergate, saying that the president is trying to institute a coup. What do you think? Our phone number, 813-239-9663. We haven't had any phone calls yet, but we do have a bunch of emails. James in St. Pete says, I'd be interested in knowing how the Washington Post got that recording. It's a very high-quality recording. I'm interested in where they got that, too. Very interested. Amin writes, why are you all surprised? Trump has been saying crazy things since he was born, including the false claims from that phone call. He repeated them so many times. You are surprised? I am not, but nothing will happen to him. Bottom line, writes Amin. What do you think? Here's the president trying to get the Georgia Secretary of State to change the results of the election. David writes this, it's weird to hear the president flailing like this, pretty pathetic. Most dictators would be more forceful and macho. Trump is just sad and petty, writes David. And then another email comes from Ron in West Tampa. Trump displays clearly sociopathic traits, as his discussion with the men in Georgia shows, a manipulative and pushy mindset exemplifies how devoid of intellect or character he is, just like his father, Fred Trump. Absolutely in line with his persona, it should be clearly considered criminal the way he spoke, writes Ron in West Tampa. And then Randy in Palm Harbor says, I think it's time we quit trying to reason with this president. He's clearly out of his mind, writes Randy in Palm Harbor. What do you think? 813-239-9663. In the next hour, Sean is going to play longer excerpts from this phone call. And Sean is also going to get to the bottom of how to get a COVID-19 vaccine. There have been problems already in the rollout in the Tampa Bay area, the rollout today for the vaccine. And he's also going to be talking with Congresswoman Kathy Castor. So it should be a good show in the next hour. Let's go to Susan in Tarpon Springs. Hi, Susan. You're on MNF. What do you think?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. So the thing that confuses me, I guess, is I'm a retired therapist, actually, and people don't tend to look at the mental health perspective of this. We're not supposed to diagnose people unless we do an in-person evaluation. So I'm not actually diagnosing, but it's pretty clear to me and to a lot of other people that are mental health professionals that the current president has a lot of issues. He's very paranoid. He's very delusional. He's very grandiose. And people keep looking at this as though it's a big political thing rather than looking at maybe they need to do some kind of an intervention, although I doubt that he would accept it. But if people maybe tried to look at maybe those that are closest to him could possibly talk him into getting some counseling or something, again, I doubt that he would accept that. But I really do think there's mental health issues going on here, and the more desperate he gets, the more he tries to manipulate people. And if he was just an ordinary citizen, he probably would be under a 48 or 72-hour observation because he's a danger to others, and so, he's proven this over and over and over again.
Susan, what as a mental health professional, what in that part of the phone call that we played would tip you off to say that he needs an intervention?
Well, and this isn't just based on that. I did listen to part of his speech on the computer the other day. I've read what people have said about it. This is based on behavior I've been watching for the past 4 years. When he doesn't get his own way, he throws tantrums. He's extremely grandiose. He thinks that everything is about him. That's a sign of narcissism, generally, thinking that everything is about you, everything is personalized against him, and that when people are not doing what he wants, then he gets very angry and he gets very mean and very cruel, which also those are not symptoms of healthy thinking. Those are signs of very unhealthy thinking, that everything is about me. If I don't get my own way, then I'm going to try to be nice to people. And if that doesn't work, then I'm going to get angry. I'm going to get mean. I'm going to get passive aggressive. And, these are behaviors that generally require some kind of intervention if the person's willing to have an intervention, somebody to sit down and talk to them about what they're actually doing, about how they're harming themselves and harming others.
And as you said, it's a long shot, though, because people around him don't want to say this to him.
No, they don't. Yeah. They want to enable him. And I think the more that you enable somebody, the worse things they're going to get, which is unfortunate. I just find it very confusing because the things that I keep reading, people keep portraying what he does as stunts. Like he's some cute little toddler that's playing a little game. Oh, look at the stunt that he's doing now. But it's not a stunt. He's harming people. He's harming people over and over and over again. And I guess what I don't understand is in this country, we have some incredibly intelligent people. So why isn't anybody stepping up to the plate, being responsible, and doing something about
that? That is the big question. Susan, thanks a lot. Thank you for that. All right. Good to hear from you. Congressman Louie Gohmert had filed a lawsuit trying to get the results of the election overturned. He filed the lawsuit against Vice President Mike Pence. It's a long story, but the courts looked at the lawsuit and said, nah, And that happened on Saturday. But Louis Gohmert, now that his lawsuit, he's trying to help the president to try to overturn the election. Louis Gohmert, the congressman from Texas, is now suggesting that the next step is violence. Let's listen to this.
With regard to the standing issue, if a member of Congress who is going to object to electors that were fraudulently sent there, and a state has sent two sets, and I don't have standing to go to court and say the Elector Act, it has got an unconstitutional provision. If I don't have standing to do that, nobody does. And if the appropriate defendant is not the vice president that under the Constitution has the power to make that determination, then there is no. But if bottom line is the court is saying, we're not going to touch this. You have no remedy. Basically, in effect, the ruling would be that you got to go to the streets and be as violent as Antifa and BLM.
Well, let me ask you, Congressman Gohmert.
All right, so that's Louis Gohmert on Saturday on Newsmax, which is a conservative news outlet, suggesting that the next step, as every time an ally of the president tries to get the results of the election overturned, the next step may be violence. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. This Wednesday is a big day. That's when Congress meets to certify the Electoral College vote. And there's also major demonstrations being called for by conservative Trump allies. They want people to go to Washington. The Proud Boys is one of the groups that's leading that effort. And it could be a very dangerous day this Wednesday in Washington, D.C. Let's go back to the phones, and we're going to go to Bill in Largo. Bill, thanks for calling. What would you like to say?
Yeah, hi, Rob. Yeah, I agree with Susan, and I'm one of those who, for I guess the longest time, thought not so much this was a stunt, but it was he was just a master manipulator to, you know, say and do whatever he needed to say or do to get his way. But listening to that, it really does sound like he believes that. It doesn't, unless he's so good at manipulating that he can make you believe that he's really sincere and genuine about it. But that's frightening.
You're saying he sounds delusional. He sounds like he really believes that he won the election.
Yeah, but he's not. Exactly. But he's not. It's not like a game to him. You're right. It's delusional. And then you hear this Gohmert, and he's not much different. But the one thing, and I'll be short here. The one thing I wanted to say about what Carl Bernstein said is, when I heard that yesterday, I thought, God, that would be the worst thing for people, Republicans, to persuade Donald Trump to resign before the end of his term. That would put Vice President Pence in a position of president, and I have no doubt that he would pardon Trump. So I know Carl Bernstein, you know, that it's just not going to happen, but gosh, that would be frightening if Pence got in a position where he could just pardon this man and let him off the hook.
Yeah.
I hope Biden doesn't let him off the hook either.
All right.
I hope he's prosecuted.
Bill, thanks a lot. Thanks for your phone call. We'll see what kind of pardons the president himself gives to people. There are some people that think that he's going to pardon himself. Kevin writes this, here's an actual crime, not doing your job of protecting the American people from the worst health crisis in American history. Instead, whining about the election, writes Kevin. Let's see, I'm going to go to the next signed email. And I have to go down the list, a lot of unsigned. Here's somebody that calls himself Baroque. I am more curious to what foreign influence is controlling Mr. Trump. His actions are in fear and desperation. What is he fearful of, writes Baroque. All right, let's go back to the telephones. And Frank Knox is our phone producer today. Let's go to Remy in Lakeland. Hi, Remy, you're on M&F.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Love your show. I know you mentioned pardons. I just want to make a quick comment on the fact that I was hoping for Edward Snowden to be pardoned. I mean, come on, he exposed that We are being blatantly lied to by the NSA. Of course, as you know, former director of the NSA, James Clapper, under oath in front of Congress, lied and said that they're not spying on all of our metadata. That turned out to be a huge lie. So I was hoping Trump could at least do something before he gets out and pardons Snowden. But on a more relevant topic, you know, this whole disaster with the voting, this could all be prevented in 2024 if we just simply, I mean, it's not rocket science, go to paper ballots. I mean, it would prevent all this. We would have paper ballots. Whoever could have police officers or whatever security counting them, and this not happen. The fact that these voting machines are online is a little bit disconcerting.
Yeah, but Remy, we have paper ballots here in Florida. I don't know where you vote, but we do have paper ballots here in Florida, and they can be checked, and they are not online. So that, you know, Remy, thank you. Thank you for your phone call. Let's go to Richard in Largo. Richard, thank you for calling. What would you like to say?
Hi. Two things stood out right away listening. He's so desperate to change the results in Georgia, but it wouldn't result in him having enough electoral votes to overthrow the election.
Yeah, you'd need four states, right? So
yeah. So, and listening to him, he was referring to himself in the third person, and that doesn't strike me as a sane, rational person. He kept saying, "You've hurt the president," instead of "You've hurt me." And what is the ultimate goal of all these Republicans backing him? That's what I want to know. How can they? I mean, they all took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution, yet they're all advocating destroying the Constitution.
I guess they're fearful of the Trump base. Because the Trump base right now controls the Republican Party, so if they're running for re-election in 2022, they have to fear that Trump base.
And staying in power, they're willing to throw away their principles, if they have any, and their dignity, and go with him. And isn't this sedition when you're advocating the overthrow of the government?
Yeah. It is. Richard, thank you. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
All right. Good to hear from you. Let's go to Marvin in Newport Richey. Marvin, what are your thoughts?
You know, first of all, hearing all this and thinking about the past 4 years, it's like a Kurt Vonnegut novel, except not funny.
Without the laughs, yeah.
Right, exactly. And the other thing that occurs to me is this is what happens when you elect a celebrity, a TV celebrity, as president of the United States. And the ultimate end game, what really happens is they don't like being canceled. And he's been canceled. He's not taking it well.
Yeah, I guess so. All right. Marvin, thanks a lot. Thanks for the phone call.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you for everything. Love your show.
Thank you for saying that. Let's go to Andy in Dunedin. Andy, you're on. What would you like to say?
Yeah, that previous caller, he nailed it. But yeah, that third person thing was weird. Very weird. As far as what Gohmert had to say, it's funny how these politicians of his ilk would always call or reference violence while they themselves will cower behind their gated community, behind their security personnel. These are the same persons that would send our kids to war but would shield their own from doing such a thing that could cause problems within their own families. But, yeah, times are getting weird.
All right, Andy, thanks a lot. Thanks for that.
Thanks, Bob.
All right, just taking people's comments about the controversial phone call from President Trump to the Georgia Secretary of State. Sean is going to play more of this phone call in the next hour, so stay tuned. And Charlie and Brandon writes, Trump could be playing to the echo chamber to resign, like Carl Bernstein said, but then Pence would pardon him. Let it play out where Trump tries to pardon himself. That would be the tie the knot. No one is above the law. Case closed, writes Charlie in Brandon. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up on our comment line, 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. I'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. And stay tuned for the Midpoint program with Sean Canaan. Frank Knox has been our phone producer today. And this is 88.5 FM WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg. First, we're going to go up to Washington, D.C. and get the latest news. And then right after that, we'll hear the Midpoint program on WMNF Tampa.